The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to begin by looking at the latest on health and healing and why walnuts and ginger are so important for your overall well-being. The aronia berry, give you the latest on that as well. From our environmental section today, humanity falls deeper into ecological debt, from the staff writers of a Terra Daily, very important short commentary. Then the latest from Fukushima, what did TEPCO and the media hide from us? Then protests mark rises in environmental awareness in China. It seems as though as the Chinese become more affluent, they're becoming more aware that they shouldn't be working or living in a toxic environment. That's good. Our commentary today will be from Robert Perry from Op-Ed News. Tea Party gets Constitution wrong. And time permitting, and I'm not sure we will have that time, our issue of the day will come from a short commentary from Jesse Jackson. We ignore poverty, but it's on the rise. And if I can't get to that today, I will get to it tomorrow. So we have a lot to talk about. And a little later on, I'll be opening up the lines because many people yesterday attended our viewing of Knocking on the Devil's Door and then a wonderful panel discussion for 2 hours. And then we took a break and then came back and watched the full second feature documentary, Death by Medicine. So it was a 7-hour evening for those of you who got there on time. We didn't get out of there till after 11:30. So reflections on that and what it means in a very positive way as a new beginning. Let's start. Now, I first read a study on why walnuts were good for us back in 1977. And at that time, some physicians working for Loma Linda University Medical School, which is principally based upon Seventh-day Adventist principles, and not smoking, not drinking, having a healthy diet, showed that if you had a handful of walnuts twice a week, it lowered your incidence of heart disease. In the last 2 years, I've probably read 30 separate articles on different nuts, pistachios, almonds, macadamia nuts, and how they help keep you healthy, mainly because of the type of oils, the length of the fatty acid, the chains of fatty acid are what really matter. And therefore, the greater variety of nuts that you consume, let's say having some almonds and some pistachios, or some macadamia nuts. A lot of people say, oh, it's too fat. No, it's not. It's very good for you. Throw them into a blender. Well, now the latest comes from the Elaine Marshall University School of Medicine, and here's what it says. Walnuts may lower breast cancer risk. I'll quote this. In this experiment with mice, modest amounts of walnuts were part of a regular diet, and they had a significant decline in breast cancer risk. And the amount that would be equivalent for a human is 2 ounces a day. That's a small amount. That would be equivalent to what would fit into a spoon. So 1 spoonful of walnuts a day can help that. Well, if that can reduce the risk of breast cancer, why not take some more nuts? And this was supported by the American Institute for Cancer Research. So, good news. Now, another nutrient that we should be using, in fact, I had some last night, is ginger. Now, I like to take ginger. You take about a 3 or 4 inch piece. You peel off the outer skin, and then you grate it. And then you take very thinly sliced garlic, slice it, as if almost you were slicing it with a razor, very thin. Then you take some jalapeno peppers, and you gently stir fry this, never hot enough to kill the enzymes, therefore it's living food, but enough to release its aromatic and essential oils so they're biologically available and taste great. And then, of course, you can mix that into brown rice or anything else you want because it's very versatile. Now, I love mustard, and mustard, of which there are over 100 varieties, are very powerful antibacterial, antiviral, anti-cancer. It's a miracle food, mustard. Now, ginger diced up and raw and then blended with mustard, and you can put that across, want to try something you never tried before, a sweet onion, and just put a thin layer of mustard ginger across the onion and try that in a salad. I like to experiment. I'm always experimenting. And as long as someone doesn't die, it's a success. So, you know, regular food, forget about it. That's just boring. No brown rice here. Make it fun. If it doesn't work, so what? You know, you learn something. Anyhow, there's a new study published by the British Journal of Nutrition, and it found that whole ginger extract was found to inhibit the growth of prostate cancer grafts by 56%. And, quote, the human equivalent dose of the ginger extract was found to be approximately 560 milligrams. That, by the way, that's under a gram. That's nothing. That's 1/28th of an ounce. We're talking about a small amount. I think we should be using more. But for all the men in this audience who have an enlarged prostate, just take some ginger and juice it. That's it. Little 1 ounce piece. Boom. Juice it. It's great for you. Now, I take a protein powder each morning that has hemp, brown rice, and pea powder, split pea powder. And it's the combination of the amino acids I find to be best suited for maintaining muscle metabolism and muscle strength and muscle integrity. Here's the latest. I just read this morning from the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry. According to this study, 3 weeks of consuming a supplement containing pea protein was associated with a reduction in systolic blood pressure. And other researchers reported that just a tiny amount of this could make a difference. So that means less stroke and less heart disease and less death overall. So, and why? Because evidently it is the ability of the pea protein to inhibit the activity of an angiostin as a converting enzyme by about 20%. So who knew that in this split pea there was an ability to block a process that would otherwise cause problems with our heart? So that's good news. Now, there is, in the vitamin C that I use, there's aronia. And most people have never heard of aronia. A-R-O-N-I-A. It's a berry. But Medical University of Lodz reported that people suffering from metabolic syndrome, that would be your diabetes or cardiovascular disease, including clotting, had enormous improvement when they took aronia berry. This was published in the European Journal of Nutrition. The scientists reported the potential benefits of the extracts from aronia and why. They believe it's because of the anthocyanin content of the berries. Quote, anthocyanin are lipid-lowering, that means fat-lowering, anti-aggregate, that means stopping the blood clots from forming in your legs and in your veins, and also direct vasoactive ingredient. That's according to studies that I'm reading there from right here. In lay language, this means that by taking aronia berry, you're able to help prevent heart attacks and stroke. And finally, resveratrol, may prevent metabolic syndrome, in this, according to this study. Now, we've talked a lot about why we should have, I believe, between 100 to 200 milligrams of aronia berry per day, and because of all the good stuff that it does. And this is just one more reason why we should. So, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, stroke, coronary artery disease, they're all associated. So take this and you can help prevent that. Finally, two things. The purple potato shows blood pressure promise. Now, most people don't eat purple potatoes, but you should. They're extraordinarily nutritious. They have double the nutrition as a regular potato. And that purple is where you're getting a lot of your phytonutrients. And in this particular study, which was presented at the National Meeting of the American Chemical Society, they found that you can lower your blood pressure by eating purple potatoes. Quote from their study, "The potato, more than perhaps any other vegetable, has an undeserved bad reputation that has led many health-conscious people to ban them from their diet. Many potato people think fattening, high carbs, empty calories. In reality, when prepared without frying and served without butter, margarine, or sour cream, one potato only has 110 calories and dozens of healthy phytochemicals and vitamins. We hope our research helps to remake the potato's popular nutrition image." So, purple potatoes, and you can, I like to take a purple potato. You can steam a purple potato, steam at the same time, you can steam a sweet potato, then take the skin off and blend them both together with anise and fennel and clove, and then stuff that into an avocado and sprinkle pine nuts on it, a little olive oil on it, and salt and pepper. That's a delicious lunch. And last up, organic tomato juice, more nutrition containing than conventional juice. And here's what it says from Food Chemistry, the peer-reviewed journal. Quote, "Using principal component analysis, results show that phenolic compounds and hydrophilic antioxidant capacity were responsible for the differentiation between organic and conventional tomato juices," unquote. And this is from the University of Barcelona. Now, what this means in lay language is this. Organic tomato juice has more nutrition than regular non-organic tomatoes. Well, we'll just put that up there with all the other studies showing the organic is better. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
You have no fear. Put your hands on your hip and let your backbone slip and work out.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. Tonight, 7 o'clock to 11 o'clock at an all-green nightclub downtown, you're my guest. Come free to the club. If you buy anything, like a water juice, you'll pay for that, but you're getting in and can spend the whole night dancing for free. My way of saying thank you for all the support you've given to me and this station. And so I'm saying thank you on behalf of the management of the station and look forward to seeing you. You can call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. We just need to know you're coming so we don't have more people there, which is almost always the case, and there's room in the club. I don't want anyone to have to wait outside when they should be inside socializing and dancing. Young, old, single, married, you're all welcome. It's a night of celebration. The only thing I ask is I'm going to be signing books for an hour. Please, no health questions tonight, all right? It's my chance to stop the work I've been doing and celebrate with you and dance and have a great time. I've mixed all the music, and Jackie Wilson, you just heard, in my opinion, one of the greatest entertainers and underappreciated entertainers. I may do a documentary on his life. I know what I want to do with it, and when you have that much talent and a whole generation's oblivious to him. Anyhow, I'm going to have a little bit of 50s rock and roll, going to have some Motown, and then get into disco, and finish at the end with some 90s, but I got a 45 minutes in there of Caribbean and Latino music, so it's going to be a nice spread of music. Nothing modern, because quite frankly, I don't like any of the modern music. I just don't think people have voices and can sing. They have nothing. Oh, anyhow, I won't get into that. So I look forward to seeing you tonight. Now, from our environmental section, this was a joint effort by the entire staff from Paris of Terra Daily. And here's what it says. It's short, but I thought it was very important for us. Humankind will slip next week into ecological debt, having gobbled up in less than 9 months more natural resources than the planet can replenish in a year. The most dominant species in Earth's history, in other words, is living beyond the planet's threshold of sustainability, trashing the house it lives in. At its current pace of consumption, humankind will need, in the next 15 years, a second globe to satisfy its voracious appetites and absorb all of its waste. This is according to the latest calculations. Earth's 7 billion citizens, 9 billion by then, are using more water, cutting down more forests, needing more fish than nature can reproduce. At the same time, we are disgorging more CO2 pollutants and chemical fertilizers than the atmosphere, soil, and oceans can soak up without severely disrupting the ecosystems that have made our planet such a comfortable place for Homo sapiens to live. Counting down from January the 1st of this year, human activity has exceeded its budget, dubbed Earth Overshoot Day, has receded by about 3 days each year since 2001. The tipping point into non-sustainability happened about 1972. And this year, researchers estimate that the equivalent of the Earth's resource quota will be depleted by next Monday. That's like spending your annual salary 3 months before the year is over and eating into your savings year after year. Pretty soon, you're running out of savings. Even as the Earth's capacity to host our ever-expanding species diminishes, the demands on eco-services, the term scientists use to describe nature's bounty, continues to grow. From soaring food prices to crippling effects of climate change, our economies are now confronting reality of years of spinning beyond our means. End quote. That's just a staggering assessment that we are. Here's the catch-22. I'll put it as simply as I can. When China was a poor nation, its people had to save. So it had the highest savings per family in the world. Second was India. And for decades, that's what happened. Now, you have 500 million educated, working middle class, comfortably working middle class, people from India and China. They're wanting what we have. They're wanting a television in every room, a car for each person. They want to eat the high-calorie processed foods. They want the steak, the McDonald's. They want all this. And they've saved for it. But to supply them with the hardwood floors and all the other special things that make up their environment, China has had to cut down enormous forests. It has no more of its own resources, so it's going around the world, by the way, using our T-bills. I'll give you some inside information that no one on Wall Street has told you. They probably don't know, but I do, because I know someone close to the situation. China's not stupid. What they've done is this. They realize America will never pay back the money. Can't. It's in the trillions of dollars, $6 trillion worldwide. China was holding over $1.5 trillion of our T-bills. In other words, our IOUs. We gave them an IOU, they gave us cash. So what's it doing? China wants to get off holding the dollar as a reserve currency. It wants its own currency as a reserve currency along with a mixed currency like using Brazil's currency, which is probably the most stable economy in the Western Hemisphere, far more so in the United States, and growing at about 11% per year. So what they're doing is they're buying factories, they're buying massive amounts of land, they're going into countries like Africa, and they're the new colonizers of Africa. Ethically and morally, what they're doing is reprehensible and wrong. How they treat their people is wrong. How they treat people of religious background is wrong. The human rights is all wrong. They have so much they're doing wrong at the political level. I'm not talking about the average Chinese person. They're no different than you and I. But their political system is extraordinarily tyrannical and corrupt. But they're also smart. And they hold all the cards this moment. They can do any kind of abuse imaginable, dwarfing anything that Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi did. You take those two little clowns and put them together, and they're chump change compared to the human rights abuses and the killings and the imprisonment and taking the organs of living people like the Falun Gong. 100 million members of Falun Gong. That's one-third of our population who practice a simple form of meditation. It's not even a religion. And yet, over a million of them are put into military hospitals where their organs are harvested. And then when they finally have to harvest their lungs or heart or liver, they just incinerate them. And they get away with this. We know all this. Our State Department knows it, but we can't do a darn thing and won't do anything because we can't go back next month and say, you're going to buy at the next auction, you're going to buy our debt. Yeah, they'll buy our debt. But out the back door goes that. And it goes into buying humongous tracts of land in South America, Africa, Russia. So they're becoming quickly the world's largest foreign-owned or foreign-leased land baron. Now, of course, Russia has more land than any other nation that's arable and usable. And that's an enormous asset. It also has gold and oil and timber and the largest forest in the world. The China has destroyed its own environment. It's the fastest desert encroaching country in the world. And its major cities are at risk. 14,000 towns and villages have been overtaken by the desert and destroyed. And they have no way they can stop it. So what do? They go to Peru and they give billions of dollars. And they buy the hardwood forest, they cut it down, and take it back, so now they have that. And they'll go to another country and take some other commodity, and then they take it back. All to feed this voracious appetite of these hundreds of millions and growing middle-class people. And the same is done in India. One of the fastest forms of farming in India is water farming. You heard me correctly, water farming. It means a person has a small plot of land, they go and get a drill, they drill down 100, 200, 400 feet, then they hit a pocket of water, and then they get a little truck, and they put a 500-gallon tank on the back of the truck. They pump water from that well into the trunk and take it into the ghettos, and they sell the water. Because well water is extremely difficult to get, and the water in the city is toxic. So, but now this water doesn't last long, and all over India are hundreds of thousands of abandoned wells. That means the land now can't be farmed because the water that could have been used for irrigating plants has been sold to people, and hence are out of water. So everything you could humanly do, stupid, corrupt, India is doing it. I don't know anything they're doing right when it comes to their management of their resources. Individuals know what they should do, but they're not doing it. So what this essay is telling us is that we are now past peak resources. We're past peak oil. That was 1950s. And this is saying we went past peak resources in the 1970s, which means this. What does this mean? How does this impact me, Gary? It means that today you can go to a store and buy anything, because someone's willing to exploit the environment without any thought for will we have that environment tomorrow. Whether it's fish, will we have any fish tomorrow, or trees, doesn't matter, water, because today they make the money. Tomorrow, it's not here, so let's not worry about it. We cannot sustain the planet for its resources, which means then that the United States working class will begin to have its environment look like Camden, New Jersey streets. I've been on Camden streets. I've filmed on Camden streets several times. And it looks like, kind of looks like Berlin after the Second World War. I mean, it is the ghetto of ghettos in all of America. It shouldn't be that way, but that's what happens when you don't have the rich and powerful, the policymakers, opinion leaders, you don't have the corporate interest who can profit from the environment, in which case they keep it clean, neat, everything nice, safe. That's going to happen to 60% of America. Next up, there is protest, however. This comes from the Hanning staff writers in China. Quote, protests mark rising environmental awareness. A major anti-pollution protest has forced the Chinese government to take swift action for the second time in as many months, spurred by a rising environment movement of environmental consciousness. More than 500 residents living near a plant making solar panels protested for 3 days this week in the eastern city of Hanning, forcing authorities to temporarily shut the factory, which belongs to the U.S. Owned Jinko Solar. The incident came just a month after authorities in the northeastern city of Daling agreed to relocate a chemical plant following similar protests, underscoring official concern over mounting public anger about pollution. Quote, citizens, particularly a rising Chinese middle class, have become more aware about how deep the impact of environmental issues is to their health. Unquote. They are no longer willing to take it passively. So, how many protests were there in China last year? Over 100,000. You heard me right. I didn't say 100,000 protesters. I said 100,000 separate protests. Did you hear about any of them? Even one of them? No. They have found their voice, and they will not be intimidated. There are too many of them for the police to arrest them all, beat them, kill them, which the Chinese police would do in a heartbeat without thinking. In fact, only in China is the victim charged, I think it's $5, for the bullet before they shoot you in the back of the head with it. Yeah, so much for Mao's legacy. And finally, what is TEPCO hiding? You know TEPCO? This is from Takshiya Hirose, from a Counterpunch in Japan. When did the radiation start to leak from Fukushima nuclear power plant, and how far has it spread? Quote, about this, our greatest interest, the Japanese government announced nothing for several days after the earthquake occurred. They just described the facts, saying they, quote, happened in the past tense, explaining neither the cause of the explosion nor the mechanisms. They never talked about expectations of danger. What is the worst scenario that this nuclear accident might lead to? A reporter asked this to the chief cabinet secretary at a news conference, but whether because he chose not to answer, didn't want to answer, nothing was answered. Like the government, most of the media, rather than informing us of the dangers posed by this accident, kept claiming groundlessly there was no problem. The stock phrase used by both Etika NNO and the TV so-called experts, no immediate effects on health. What does that mean? That radiation effects start 1 year or 10 years later? That you can stand in front of a nuclear power plant and eat your food and you can be irradiated for a year, but there's no problem? What does it mean, no immediate effects? Well, people would have dropped dead in the streets of acute radiation sickness, as they did after the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But that is not what we're talking about. The question is whether radiation taken into children's body is safe. The experts, who all were government selected, said no problem. But now we have found there is a problem. And by the way, from our press conference last night, we also found for the first time that they have now found radiation hotspots all over Tokyo. All over. Well, that's 35 million people. What are you going to tell those 35 million people? You're living in a toxic environment. You are getting radiation. You're drinking. You're eating radiation. You're exposed in the radiation. There's hot spots everywhere. But don't worry. Be happy. And we have supported the government. And Obama, in particular, has made it a non-issue. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to go to your calls in a moment. For those of you who are at the two screenings and the press conference last night, you can call now. Be happy to take your calls. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And before we go there, this is just to put something into a little different perspective. And being a person who appreciates context, especially using history as context, when someone tells me that they believe in the Constitution and they want our country run by the Constitution, and I listen to their arguments more often than not, I don't hear that it's a constitutional issue. And that's where it can be confusing, because more often than not, it's based upon the Articles of Confederation. And there's a substantial difference between the two. It is now an article of faith in many of the Tea Party and on the American right that the founders wrote the U.S. Constitution to restrict the power of the federal government and protect states' rights. But that analysis is simply incorrect. I don't condemn anyone for having a wrong perspective. I just want them to know, before you make any more choices or listen to any more rhetoric of the Glenn Becks or the Sean Hannitys or Mark Levins or people who claim to understand what the issue is, please do a little more due diligence. Like any government document, the Constitution can only be understood in the context of what it replaced and why. The United States Constitution superseded the Articles of Confederation, which guided the new country starting in 1777. The Articles of Confederation granted broad authority to the states with only a weak national government. As the Revolutionary War wore on, and during the early years of peace, many American leaders, I'm talking about George Washington, John Adams, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, my favorite, came to view the Articles of Confederation as unworkable and a threat to the survival of the new nation. The Continental Army was especially disdainful of the Articles because they didn't grant taxing authority to the national government, and thus, when the states reneged on promising funding, which they did frequently, soldiers were left without pay and without even munitions. They had no bullets put in their guns. They couldn't even get a different uniform. They were fighting in rags. The answer to this political crisis took shape in 1786 with a growing movement for a much stronger federal government, leading to secret meetings in Philadelphia in 1787 to draft a new governing document, and that became our Constitution. Now, the Constitution created the framework for a powerful federal authority that could not only declare war and negotiate treaties, but could tax and print money and regulate interstate commerce and undertook a host of other governing activities. And besides the sweeping federal authority delineated by the Constitution, the document also dropped key language from the Articles of Confederation that had suggested the supremacy of the states. The Articles had described the United States not as a government or even a nation, but as a firm league of friendship among the states for their common defense, the security of liberties, and their mutual and general welfare. If that suggestion of the state supremacy wasn't clear enough, the Confederation Article II declared each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right which is not by this Confederation expressly delegated. And very few powers were delegated to the federal government. That powerful state's rights language was either eliminated by the Constitution or subsequently watered down. Then you have all of the people running around now in the blogospheres talking about the 10th Amendment argument. And some Tea Party activists in particular will often cite the 10th Amendment to the Constitution as evidence that the founders were strong advocates for states' rights, since they say, remember, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, not prohibited by it to states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. But again, the Tea Partiers are missing the point. The Constitution granted broad powers to the federal government, even over the regulation of national commerce, so there were far fewer powers left to the states. The Tenth Amendment amounted to a sop to mollify the anti-federalist bloc that was trying to block ratification of the Constitution by the 13 states. To further appreciate how modest the Tenth Amendment concession was, you also must compare its wording with Article 2 of the Confederation. Remember, Article 2 says each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, while the Tenth Amendment simply says powers not granted to the federal government are reserved to the states or individuals. Stripped away the new national governing document were the principles of state sovereignty and state independence. In effect, American sovereignty had been transferred to the republic that the Constitution had created. States no longer were dominant. They were subordinate to the we, the people, as represented in the Union, the United States of America. And of course, the anti-federalists did not entirely go away, especially when it became clear to the agrarian South that its economic model based on slavery was losing ground to the growing industrial power of the North and the influence of the emancipation movement. So in the early 1930s, Southern politicians led the nullification challenge to the federal government, asserting that states had the right to nullify federal laws, such as the tariff on manufactured goods, but they were beaten back by President Andrew Jackson, who threatened to deploy troops to South Carolina to enforce the federal supremacy established by the Constitution. In December 1832, President Jackson denounced the nullifiers and declared the power to annul a law of the United States assumed by one state incompatible with the existence of the Union, contradicted expressly by the letter of the Constitution, unauthorized by its spirit, inconsistent with every principle on which it was founded, and destructive by the great object of which it was formed. In essence, President Jackson rejected as treason the notion that states could secede if they wished, noting that the Constitution, quote, forms a government, not a league, a reference to the line in the Articles of Confederation that had termed the fledgling United States a firm league of friendship among the states, not a government. The nullification crisis was diffused, but a few decades later, the South continued resistance to the constitutional preeminence of the federal government, led to secession and the formation of the Confederacy. And it took the Union's victory in the Civil War to firmly settle the issue of the sovereignty of the National Republic over the states. However, the defeated South still balked at the principles of equal rights for blacks and invoked states' rights to defend segregation during the Jim Crow era. And white Southerners had amassed enough political clout, especially within the Democratic Party, to fend off civil rights for blacks. Now, the battle over states' rights was joined again in the 1950s when the federal government finally committed itself to enforcing the principles of equal protection under the law as prescribed by the 14th Amendment. And many white Southerners were furious that their system of segregation was being dismantled by federal authority. The South's anger was reflected by the prevalence of the Confederate battle flag on pickup trucks and in the store windows, and white Southerners were expressing their bravado of secession, even if it was more tough talk than anything real. Gradually, the American right retreated from outright support of racial segregation and muffled the threats of secession, and until, I guess it was Rick Perry of Texas who started to bring it up again. Now, instead, the right has sought to impose a reinterpretation of the Constitution by revising the history of the United States and pretending that our founding fathers designed the Constitution as a document to establish the supremacy of the state over the federal government. This revisionist view is now at the heart of the Tea Party movement and has powerful propaganda support from the right-wing news media. And since few Americans understand the reasons for the Constitution or the fact that it represented a major consolidation of federal power, this right-wing disinformation campaign has proven effective. And Tea Party activists add to the misimpression about the founders' intent by dressing in Revolutionary War costume and channeling the founders' supposed hatred of the federal government. And the Tea Partiers wave "Don't Tread on Me" flags as if the American revolutionaries were addressing that to their own government, not the British colonists. Interesting, the Tea Partiers ignore another common banner of the era, showing a serpent representing the 13 colonies cut into pieces with the inscription, Join or Die. That banner recognized the need of the disparate American states to cooperate as one nation or perish. The right so-called originalist thinking about the Constitution, how the founders allegedly disdained federal authority, also ignores the fact that nearly all the founding fathers were advocates of replacing the Articles of Confederation, which is the state sovereignty document, with the Constitution. And among its biggest advocates was George Washington, who commanded the Continental Army when it was hamstrung by a lack of resources caused by the absence of federal taxing authority in the Articles of Confederation. So please, before you condemn your thoughts and actions and ideals to that of the junk heap of history, do your homework. I appreciate those who want to take away excessive power of an excessively corrupt government. The military-industrial complex is massively corrupt. It's nothing but an insider's warehouse where everyone lines up and takes whatever contracts for privatizing resources or capitalizing on our conflicts, whether it's providing a runway at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan, or cleaning people's laundry in Iraq. We need to strip down our federal government to the departments and resources and employees necessary to function as facilitators for a common good. I am not the only person who has watched two people working and 16 people standing around chattering and watching, and we pay for all 18. That would not be tolerated in any other area of our lives. Our government would be more effective. I also am deeply offended by the idea on the left, in particular, to create bureaucracies without looking to see later, do they actually function at what level of efficiency and compatibility with our needs. We create something and walk away, and it grows and engorges and becomes morbidly obese because it has the power to do so, and then it is too big and too powerful with its union public representation to dismantle, to challenge, to correct, to fire, to mollify, to modify. You've created a monster. The left refuses to acknowledge that. The right refuses to be detailed in what it really sees as excesses. I believe the states need more rights. I believe that both the Articles of Confederation were too excessive, and the Constitution created the beginning of what we would have today, an out-of-control government. And it's not just $16 muffins I'm talking about. I'm Gary, and all those are my thoughts. And Mr. Perry's, I want yours now. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Be dancing to Sylvester tonight. That's who he is. Let's say hello to our first caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Gary. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, it's Luann.
Well, hi, Luann.
Listen, I was at the event, and I want to tell you, I know I'm not the only one to tell you that you were great last night. Of course, I'm talking about that historic event at the New York Society for Ethical Culture, where I believe a sold-out house of about 1,000 people got to see your two new documentaries, Knocking on the Devil's Door and Death by Medicine. Plus, we witnessed the riveting testimony of some of the most prominent activists on nuclear energy, as well as some of the children who survived the Fukushima disaster. And I'll tell you, looking around, I don't think there was a dry eye in the house. Everyone, I think, was affected by this information, the passion of the people on stage and in the documentaries, and the focused that from you and everybody on the panel was it was just amazing. And being from Long Island, I was particularly impacted by the real facts that I never realized behind the Shoreham nuclear power plant closing. You know, the lies and the corruption that surrounded the entire project. By the end of the panel discussion, though, I think the most important thing that people walked away with was a feeling of hope, and that we got real-time guidance about we, as a group of individuals, part of an empowered group, can really influence change by making our voices heard to the right people at the right time. It's a huge hole. We often find people that complain a lot and point fingers, but this was a group of people that said, this is what we need to do, and this is when we need to do it. I mean, the vibration in the room was palpable. What was also impressive to me was when you asked if there were any reporters from the major media. I think one person from the Huffington Post raised their hand. And then you asked the key question, were there any members of WBAI management or any of their program directors? And you know, the silence was deafening, Gary. You could hear a pin drop. There wasn't a hand raised. Here, I'm thinking this would have been a great opportunity for BAI to cover one of the most current and most controversial events of our time, not to mention an event presented by one of the station's top earners. It makes you wonder just how WBAI creates its priorities. I mean, granted, we had some key members of the local station board, Mitchell Cohen, Steve Brown, excellent people, but where was the management? And what other critical events like this are going on in the area that they're missing the opportunity to share with their dwindling audience? As far as I'm concerned, Gary, BAI management is asleep at the wheel. And it's a slap in the face to the supporters of the station who are getting empty promises for all the money they're pouring into the station. These promises of great programming and real-time information. Last night was real-time information. It was a historic event. I mean, I thought BAI was about impacting social change through activism and awareness. These people are living in the dark, and they're living under a rock. Is it me? Am I missing something here?
Okay. I would look at it a little differently. First, put that aside for a moment. It is only who shows up in life that counts, not who doesn't. There could have been 1,000 different people who could have showed up who didn't. I do know that according to our staff, about 2,000 people had been calling, but we'd been sold out for a long time, and even our bandwidth wasn't wide enough to. We had so many people all over the world trying to get in that they couldn't get in. We simply, even expanding our bandwidth as far as our provider could do, we couldn't get them in. So the message will start to reverberate out piece by piece by each person who was there. And there were many policymakers. There were heads of different movements there. And that's what's important. So what you had last night were solutions. Remember, three of the people on our panel had personally been responsible for closing three nuclear power plants. Carl Grossman and Harvey Wasserman, between the two of them, have closed three power plants. So the idea is, look at what you have. Look at what you're working with. We're now going to close in Indian Point. I'm going to be mentioning within the next week that we're going to have a meeting downtown. We're going to have a demonstration in front of the governor's office. Today I'm asking our audience, call Governor Cuomo and his office in New York and Albany and say no to nuclear power. If enough people call and let him know that we don't want nuclear power, then that helps us. We're willing to have new hearings where our experts, not their experts, go forward and give information about the truth. You heard the truth. You had so many newsy statements that no one had ever heard before. I had some very educated people in the audience last night, social activists, educators, professors, who didn't know what was being sold because this was unique information. So put the energy on what we can do. Honor the people who are there. I have no idea why people didn't show up or chose not to, and it's really irrelevant to me. The only thing is relevant, it was a historic moment because it is a new beginning for all those individuals who've dealt in kind of obscurity or without funding or without power in the last 15 to 20 years, who now are working together for common good. It is not about politics, it is about public health. And those are the people we should honor. Honor the people who show up and don't connect in energy the people who don't. It's their right. If people don't want to show up and be relevant, it's their right. It's not our right to tell people what they should or shouldn't do. It's our right to say thank you for coming, thank you for protesting, thank you for calling your governor, legislator, thank you for becoming involved. That's who counts, because that, at the end of the day, is what are the people who cause a movement to go forward. We are going forward. This is worldwide. They can't stop us. There are too many of us now. We're in the millions now. Not hundreds, not dozens, millions. As Harvey told me afterwards, and as Vandana Shiva told me afterwards, this was the largest gathering of positive activist minds that either one of them have seen. And Greg Palas said he didn't expect this kind of thing. I said, why not? Did you think that the enormous amount of frustration in the people in this country was just all going to be taken sublimated by drinking beer, sitting in front of a television, and watching the next Dancing with the Stars? There are lots of very positive, conscientious people who do not look at the problem, but look at the solution to that problem. That's where they put their energy, because that's something you can control. You can control what you're going to do. You cannot control what someone else will do if you don't do something. If you don't do anything, then you know that nothing will change. It will only get worse. And we heard some really scary worst-case scenarios. I'll tell you this, if the American public had, on a 60 Minutes or one of the major shows, had heard what was discussed last night by the panelists, today, it would be the number one story in the United States, because it shows how vulnerable we are to solar storms or nuclear meltdown. That's what's important. This was an important night, and I thank you very much, but don't be frustrated. Be optimistic. Last night, if it was nothing else, it was about optimism, because we are beginning to find a common, unified, positive voice. And that voice will not be still. Thank you very much, Luann.
Thank you, Gary, for being there and for having the event. It was truly amazing.
Let's say hello to George. George, you're on.
About China, I read an article about 6 months ago in the New York Times reporting that China is buying up huge tracts of land in the Serengeti Plain, because that area of the world has rich and deep amounts of lithium used in the manufacture of cell phones. Already they have started digging and mining.
Oh, they're way beyond that.
Way, really?
George, they're so far beyond that that in the United States,
yes,
16 million acres of land out in Utah in the West are being common land, public land, are being blocked off. You can't go into them anymore.
Wow.
And now the Chinese are coming in there and buying up land, leasing that land. Other countries are doing the same, because they're going to extrapolate the minerals and use them. And they are now controlling 90% of the world's essential minerals for computers and other software. And all the while, we have outsourced our natural resources. We've outsourced our labor. All because of a relatively small number, percentage-wise, of the population. Corporations and individuals believe that globalization, in all their earnestness, is the key to the future. It is their future. It's a very prosperous future for them. But when you start taking minerals out of the ground, whether it's oil, coal, gas, tritium, cobalt, that's your benefit, and that's China's leading the way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In studio, we have Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. I just want to say also that last night was, I mean, apart from everything that's been said already, and Luann was saying that, you know, you were the architect of everything there. I mean, really, I mean, you brought everything together, and it was your film, and you know, you brought these fantastic heavyweights, real heavyweights, of you know, in this, in one forum, and it's just, it has enormous implications for the future. And I think, like you've just said, that the future looks bright. I can't imagine that we couldn't close those plants now.
We will close. It's not can we, it's we will.
Right.
And those heavyweights, they sparkled. You know, it's like every one of them hit it out of the ballpark. I mean, one was just, the audience was applauding one after the other. It is not one person. It is not me. I don't say that in any sense of false modesty. Remember, I said at the very beginning when I got up there, you can't make a film by yourself. I brought my whole crew there to acknowledge them. So people saw these are the people that will spend 6 months, a year in post-production every day working on getting the best B-roll, the best special effects. It's all the people working together. The key now is that it's not about I, it, the ego, one. It is about we working together. It's the cooperation of people who have come together on a common theme, making it a better world for other people. Not making it better for Jews or Catholics or Muslims or rich or educated. Making it better for all people. Don't exclude people. I believe that we can all work together to make it a better world for all of us. Right. Even people who may not like us.
Yeah.
Look, if we manage to get a pesticide ban that causes cancer, and people say, I didn't want you messing with my right to eat my pesticide, that's okay. But at least now, something that they wouldn't have thought of, they won't get sick from. So if we can close a nuclear power plant, and other people think, well, what's wrong with nuclear? You're all a bunch of nuts. I don't personalize it. They're going to get angry at the approaches we're taking. We will take the approaches. We do not have the political strength. We don't have the economic strength. But we have truth, and we have a movement of people who are conscientious that don't want these nukes. Not only do they not want them there, I had people drive in from Toronto, Canada yesterday. They came up from Atlanta, Georgia yesterday. I mean, it was a seven-hour event, as you know, from 4 o'clock when people got there to after 11 when it finally finished, and a great group of people. They're working as a we.
Yeah.
So henceforth, think of everything that happens as we're doing it together.
Right.
And yeah. Progressives do it without stabbing each other in the eye.
Right.
By the way, one other thing. A Greek and Italian were sitting in a Starbucks one day discussing who had the superior culture. Now, over a triple latte, the Greek says, well, we had the Parthenon. And so the Italian arches the eyebrow and says, but we had the Colosseum. But then the Greek says, ah, but we gave birth to advanced mathematics. And the Italian says, mm-hmm, but we built the Roman Empire. And so on, and it went back and forth. And finally the Greek comes up with what he thinks will end the discussion with a flourish of finality. He says, we invented sex. And the Italian replies, ah, yes, that is true, but it was the Italians who introduced it to women. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Noll, and we don't believe in getting together like a bunch of people and stabbing each other in the eye and trying to figure out who is the brightest, smartest, and has the power. That's all so unnecessary. It is all so counterproductive. Tomorrow we'll be talking with Deborah Lynn Dadd on our toxic life, a look at some of our commonly used everyday products that people are not aware are highly toxic. I'll also be doing some commentaries tomorrow, and I'll also be mentioning that this Sunday at the Uptown Whole Foods health food store, I'm going to be introducing Denise Ortega. She is the first of our homesteaders to go from being a New York City police officer, retired with her husband, they're both in their mid-40s, to now she has created a whole new career and has a wonderful line of gourmet organic natural foods, from soaps and herbal deodorants and lotions, all of which she created from scratch by herself. Beautiful packaging and non-talc powders and lip balms and desserts and wheat-free muffins, you name it, she's done it. A whole gigantic line, under a year. And that's what I'm trying to get people to be aware of. If you choose to have a different life in the future, if you choose to make your life sustainable, you can do so. But how do you do it? I want people to be able to say hello to Denise at 89th and Broadway from noon until 6 this Sunday. She'll be there with her products to show how she did it. If she did it, you can do it. And there's a guy, Kenny. Kenny, who had multiple sclerosis, advanced multiple sclerosis, now he's cured. He's now doing a whole homesteading project, he and his wife. So it's not for everyone, but for those who believe that you would like to have a life beyond what you've had, you're ready for the next passage in your life, a different passage, and mastering different tools, I'm going to be working more and more with people helping him in that process, because I see that I'm seeing an evolutionary clock of probably another 2 years before you won't recognize our society. So, Sunday at noon on at 89th and Broadway, you can meet this new homesteader and see how she's completely repositioned her career and life and her families. It'll be a lot of fun. Have a nice day, everyone.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tavenfeld.